This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, the coronavirus continues to change how we live, even everyday tasks like grocery shopping. We'll hear what some grocery stores are doing to keep customers and employees safe. How we're coping with the changes. That's what the Illinois State Museum wants you to share as part of a project to document the pandemic through the eyes of Illinois residents.
The things that don't get recorded for posterity are those everyday things that seem so mundane that nobody wants to write them down. That's actually the thing that will be most interesting to future generations.
A nurse will share the viewpoint of someone on the front lines of the pandemic. And we'll look back at Lincoln's assassination and the different reactions of people when they learn the news. That and more ahead this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, the Illinois State Museum needs your help to document what is taking place right now and to show future generations what life was like during the pandemic. Later, grocery stores have worked to make shopping safer, we'll hear more, and celebrating happy hour at a distance. All that and more this hour on Statewide. Nurses are on the front lines of fighting COVID-19, but for many, treating patients during an outbreak is new. Thomas McClure served as a medic in the Illinois Army National Guard through two outbreaks, and he's now a nurse at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. Our reporter Mary Hansen talked with him about what he saw and how it helps in fighting the coronavirus.
What are you seeing and how are you protecting yourself?
It breaks down to ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, is what we're seeing these patients go into. And so these patients are pretty sick. For these people that have comorbidities, they have other things wrong with them, typically like day-to-day things like COPD, diabetes. They're definitely being affected at a higher rate, you know, and most of the ones I think that we've had have been over the age of 70 as well. My unit, we're very fortunate. We have PAPRs, so powered air purifying respirators, and that pushes air out away from my face when I wear this mask. So you can't inhale the aerosolized particles that the CDC warns about. So I'm pretty fortunate to be able to wear that mask.
You were in the National Guard as a medic. You served when there was the avian flu pandemic and then during a chickenpox outbreak. What did you remember most from those times? How was your sort of day-to-day life affected by those outbreaks?
Our day-to-day life at our camp during the avian flu pandemic, it mostly affected our food, I'll tell you. We ate powdered eggs for a year and 3 months, which was pretty terrible if you've never had to do that. The one big change that we did have when we did have the chickenpox outbreak, between like 2,000 and 3,000 people that were affected, and they were coming from a camp up north in Iraq. I was stationed in northern Kuwait at the time. They had to come through us and they got quarantined at my camp, and we had to do blood draws on all those people. Chickenpox, I know it sounds fairly innocent. As an adult, it can actually cause like some pretty severe respiratory symptoms, and it can be quite painful. So we had to quarantine those people, unfortunately, which was a lot of people to quarantine at our small camp. And then we had to draw blood on every single one of them. So it was quite the ordeal, but they were ready for it. They mobilized every medical asset on our camp, doctors, nurses, PAs, literally everybody. Like I said, we were a small camp, but with everybody doing it, we were able to test everybody that came through in a day. We had it done in a day.
Does seeing the shortage of testing frustrate you or worry you now when we look at the coronavirus outbreak?
It does. If we were able to test everybody like we did when I was overseas, if we could test everybody all at once, we would be able to know who has it and who doesn't have it. Right now, I have to assume that everybody else both does and doesn't have it. It's like Schrodinger's virus is a way one of my close nurse friends talked to me about it. And I thought it was just the best analogy. You know, Schrodinger's cat, the cat's both in the box and not in the box. You have to assume that everybody has it and doesn't have it. So you have to assume that you're carrying it as well, that you could infect everybody else. You have to assume that they have it or that they don't have it and you could give it to them. You want everybody to be wearing a mask. You want everybody to be wearing goggles.
For you outside of the hospital, what practices are you using to prevent yourself from getting this disease?
As a healthcare worker, I think we're kind of resigning ourselves to the fact that we're probably going to get it and we're hoping it doesn't affect us. We all wash our hands all the time. Like if you're a good healthcare worker, like you were practicing good hand hygiene before this, you know? But some new things that we are doing, like every night when I get off from work, I go up to our front step, take off my shoes. My wife hoses me down with Lysol, and I always say, don't spray me in the face. And then she sprays me in the face like I'm a mugger trying to take her purse. So I usually then step inside and disrobe, and then I'm in immediately in the shower, and then my clothes go downstairs in a plastic bag and get thrown in the washer. My stethoscope and everything, it goes in a bag that we bleach everything in it. Like, we are taking a lot of extra precautions just to make sure I don't bring it back into our house. But Lysol doesn't taste good, I'll tell you right now. It's not the best taste in the world.
Do not recommend.
I'm pretty sure they would say make sure not to ingest as well. So
anything else you want to add?
I'm glad I'm a nurse, and I'm glad I get to help take care of people. I know everybody's been on like social media and stuff and putting nurses up on this pedestal. Do things that actually help us, like writing your like representatives, whoever your politicians are, and telling them like, hey, we do need emergency PPE supplies. We do need to incite manufacturers into manufacturing these things. We do need more ventilators. These are all things that are going to be absolutely necessary. Make them act. They're going to listen if more people start pushing for it.
Mary Hansen talking with Thomas McClure. He's a nurse at a hospital in Springfield. Illinois schools are now teaching kids remotely. State officials say the goal is to get instruction to students by any means possible. But for families of special education students and their teachers, remote learning presents some unique challenges. Lee Gaines with Illinois Newsroom has this report.
Lauren Kamnick is at home in Deerfield with her three kids. Two have special needs. She says there's not much learning going on.
It's minute by minute, honestly. These are very, very long days.
One son, Wesley, is 10 years old. He has a rare neurodevelopmental disorder that means he has a cognitive delay and requires a feeding tube.
He's in a classroom where he's learning how to wash his hands and, you know, brush your teeth and money and that kind of thing, and he's not learning those skills.
Kamnick's other son, Oliver, is 11. He has anxiety, depression, and ADHD. He normally goes to a therapeutic day school.
Oliver, he's in an environment where they're trying to get them socially and emotionally regulated, and he's not getting that right now.
Kamnick says just trying to get through the day is hard, never mind creating a structured environment in which her kids can learn. She relies on school to provide the therapies and interventions her sons need, and also to give her a break.
If I go to the bathroom for 5 minutes, it's screaming and banging on the door nonstop. I mean, if you can hear me, it's just constant.
The struggle looks different for families depending on their child's needs. Betsy Crosswhite is at home in Wilmette with her husband and their three kids, including her 15-year-old son, Shane. Shane is on the autism spectrum, and you can hear him talking in the background.
It's hard because so much of Shane's day is reliant on his schedule. And so much of, it's not summertime yet. He's kind of a creature of habit.
Since school closed, screens are really the only way for Shane to engage with his teachers and therapists. Crosswhite says video conference calls are hard for him.
You know, it was me chasing him around with the camera while she's trying to even do one or two things for him. And it just didn't work out.
Most special needs kids have what are called individualized education programs, or IEPs. IEPs are legal documents tailored to each student's needs. Crosswhite says she took a look at Shane's educational goals recently.
No, I just think we all have to anticipate that he's not going to meet them this year, and we'll have to sort of do a redo for next year.
Special education teachers across the state have also struggled to teach their students since schools closed. Cindy Klein works with special education students east of St. Louis in southern Illinois. She set up a Google Classroom for her students. But Klein says talking to kids while they're at home isn't like being in the classroom.
They don't have that structure. They don't have all the things that we spent all year setting in place to keep them focused. And so then that escalates into problems with parents or them getting behind or them getting stressed, you know.
Klein says she's changed the way she teaches now. She says it's less about meeting their educational goals and more about making sure they're okay. Recently, she asked her students to write journal entries, and she's not grading their work as she once would.
I write back to them just like it was a letter, and I encourage them to go outside and get some sunshine. because I don't want them getting in a funk and getting depressed.
And it's not just the students who might be depressed. It's also their parents. And special needs parents are talking to each other online. They understand each other's reality, and that helps. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Aurora's mayor says his COVID-19 symptoms made him feel like he went to the edge and back. Richard Irvin held a Facebook Live update on Wednesday. He was joined by the police chief, Kristen Zeman, and police commander, Keith Cross. They've also both tested positive. Zeman says they don't know exactly how they got infected, but she says early prevention planning meetings involve large gatherings of officers, including in-person meetings with the mayor. Their symptoms varied in severity, but included cough, chills, and recurring fever. Mayor Irvin says he also had fatigue.
Not long after I took the test, I went downhill. I mean, I had an extreme headache, you know, to the point where I couldn't even think straight. And if I stood up, I would get dizzy.
The officials held the meeting to bring attention to the need for residents to follow stay-at-home social distancing measures. The city of Aurora has more than 100 confirmed cases and several deaths associated with COVID-19. Well, you might not realize it, but history is being made all around you. The Illinois State Museum wants to document what is happening here in the state. They want your help. A new initiative is asking for you to share your stories through writings, photos, and more. We'll explain how in a moment, but first I had a conversation with Erica Holst. She's the State Museum's curator of history and talked about how the idea came about.
So at the beginning of this experience, we talked about active collecting, which is the idea that you collect in the moment. And we had this awareness that something's happening, right? This is a historic moment that we're all living through, and we wanted to preserve it for posterity. And so we had actually heard that the Indiana State Historical Society was doing something similar, a collecting initiative. And we thought, like, okay, that's what we need to be doing.
It seems we don't often realize that history is being made when we're in the moment. This seems to be one of those times. This is something everybody's going to remember. We're all going to look back on it. Right now, it may seem, you know, pretty mundane, or that we're going through the same day over and over and over again because we're stuck in our houses. But that's another reason to document it this way, isn't it?
The things that don't get recorded for posterity are those everyday things that seem so mundane that nobody wants to write them down, you know, but that's actually the thing that will be most interesting to future generations is what was it like, you know, what was the parent feeling when they suddenly had to homeschool? What was the business owner feeling when they had to readjust their business model? What was someone feeling when they came down with COVID? You know, like, what's the human story at the heart of it?
Like you said, you plan to share these in the present, but also you're going to hold these for the future. So I'm guessing our grandkids would be able to see these going, you know, years later, decades later.
You know, right now we feel like there's kind of this impulse to turn back to difficult moments in history, and especially like the 1918 pandemic. And, you know, how did people cope? How did people get through it? And it's helpful to know that they did, you know, that humanity has experienced these challenges before and survived and thrived. And so hopefully, you know, what we're going through today can provide the same inspiration for people in the future.
And this is what the State Museum really is about, isn't it? It's not always about artifacts. It's about telling the story of Illinois.
It's about the people of Illinois and their experiences. It really gets to the heart of what we want to do. And so, it was a logical fit, and we're all learning on the fly. You know, we're used to having a physical building and physical objects, and so shifting to a totally digital model is new for us. But, it's working. That's what we all have to do these days.
I've got to say, a lot of people are probably like, you know, I'm working from home, or I'm watching television, doing some chores I've been putting off. And why would anyone be interested in that? What's your answer to those folks?
You know, twofold. I think, first of all, this project is giving people a space to sort of explore their feelings. You know, we've all been through something, right? Like, life as we know it ended about a month ago, and we've all got feelings of sadness of what we'd lost and anxiety for the future. And some of us are enjoying time with our family, and you might feel guilty about that. So there's a lot of things happening. And so by, you know, writing it down or taking a photo or creating artwork or, you know, or processing that story, we hope to, you know, help people. And then in the short term, as we're able to put up online exhibits and kind of show people what we've been getting. It's almost like a mirror being held up to ourselves in this time, you know, and you can kind of see like we're not alone, we're all in this together. And already from the submissions we're getting, you see some just really beautiful examples of the resiliency of the human spirit and the way people are reaching out to stay connected, even if they're physically separated. So, you know, we hope that'll be a source of inspiration to people going forward.
What are you getting from people and what are you asking for as far as, you know, any type of specific, you know, digital submissions, things of that nature? Exactly what would you be looking for?
So really anything. We our submission form gives people space to just write out their story if you just want to kind of, you know, journal almost what's going on and what your feelings are. We also have a place where you can upload a photo. So if you want to take a photo of the world around you, if you've maybe created a piece of artwork and want to send us a photo of it, if there's an object you're using around the house that speaks to the pandemic experience and you want to share it with us, we really welcome anything and everything. You know, we've gotten things that run the gamut. We've gotten photos of an inspirational sign that went up in someone's neighborhood that said everything will be okay. We've gotten a photo of toilet paper shaped cakes at the grocery store. And we've gotten photos of, you know, relatives visiting each other through a window who can't be together at this time. It's kind of like life now, right? It runs the gamut. There's all kinds of experiences and emotions that we're feeling.
It is a way for people to cope as well by sharing these stories, it seems, that, you know, people can, like you said, you know, show that everybody's in the same boat. We're all trying to get through this together.
Right. There's nobody in the state or in the country or probably in the world who this experience isn't touching. You know, we feel like everyone's story has value and we're all in this together and everyone's got their experience and we want to hear them all and cast a really wide net. So we really just encourage, you know, there's nothing too mundane or nothing too profound. We want to hear it all.
Erica Holst is curator of history for the Illinois State Museum. They want your stories and submissions to document life during the pandemic. All will be preserved in a digital archive. If you'd like to contribute to that project, you can find a link. It's at our website, statewideshow.com. There's more ahead on Statewide. We'll tell you about a small business making the best of the situation. This is Statewide. Remember, you can catch all of our shows at statewideshow.com, and our podcast is available each week through the NPR One app. A golf course just over the river in Iowa is kicking out all golfers from other states during the pandemic. Michelle O'Neill reports Glens Creek Golf Course is just enforcing the governor's orders.
In Illinois, golfers don't have the pleasure of hearing that sound. All golf courses are closed to prevent the spread of COVID-19, but that's not the case in Iowa. Ed Rivers, head of the Scott County Health Department, says this week the County Conservation Board had to limit golfing at Glens Creek to Iowa residents only.
The staff at Glens Creek reported a significant number of out-of-state golfers were from the Chicago area. Golfers from Rock Island County weren't the only out-of-state patrons golfing at Glens Creek. We know there's community spread in Scott County and many other parts of Iowa. We also know that in some of our neighboring states, the community spread is even higher.
That clearly violated restrictions in place because of the coronavirus. Last month, Iowa's governor ordered people to stay home in self-isolation for 2 weeks if they had traveled outside the state for business or vacation in the previous 14 days.
During this point in the pandemic, it's not in our community's best interest to be drawing people in from other areas in the Midwest when staying home is the best protection. I'll also note that Illinois has a stay-at-home order, and we think it's incumbent upon Illinois citizens to observe that order and not try to circumvent it by going to another state to play golf.
I'm Michelle O'Neill.
And while golf courses remain closed in Illinois, they remain open in all neighboring states except Wisconsin. Many businesses are hurting while the nation takes steps to prevent the spread of coronavirus. It's been especially painful for small, family-owned shops. Rich Egger tells us about a small business in Macomb, which is trying to create something good out of a bad situation.
The Wine Cellars has been a fixture on the downtown Courthouse Square since late 2003, but it has new owners. Craig and Julia Burns took over just a few months ago.
obviously this is not, you know, not how we had things planned out. This was not really on our radar when we took possession of the business back in November.
Due to stay-at-home orders and bans on large gatherings, the business is currently limited to package sales of wine, craft beers, and spirits. That's a drastic change for the wine cellars. Just a few weeks ago, it was also a place for people to hang out for trivia nights, sip and paint evenings, and live music on Fridays and Saturdays. In fact, social gatherings were a big part of the business. Craig Byrne says although retail sales have not been too bad during these days of social distancing, it's been a little too quiet. So he was all ears when local musician Bill Mockestead pitched an idea.
I called him one morning, and he said, well, the night before, he and Julie were talking about doing something like this.
What they all had in mind was a live Friday night concert in the events hall next door.
I've enjoyed as much of this as I can stand.
Given the ban on gatherings, no one was allowed to attend the concert in person. Instead, Burns and Mockestead encouraged people to come in to buy a bottle, then pick up a carry-out meal from a downtown restaurant before heading home to catch the concert on Facebook Live.
Yes, you know without me saying I still love you, but I've enjoyed as much of this as I can stand.
Craig Byrne says they got more than 500 individual views of the live stream.
That doesn't necessarily tell us how many people were watching, because multiple people could watch on one device. Some people could have, you know, logged on for a few minutes and then logged back off.
Burns believes the concert was a success. A number of viewers posted messages about how much they enjoyed hearing live music again. Yet the evening was about more than entertainment. It was also a fundraiser for Genesis Garden. That's a Macomb-based grassroots organization dedicated to eliminating poverty and providing shelter to families in need. The group has also led the way in ensuring that needy families are getting food during the coronavirus crisis. The pandemic has challenged families. It's challenged businesses. It's challenged the notion of what is normal. But Burns believes it could yield some long-term good.
I think that this has forced us all to really focus a lot more on local, a lot more on each other, a lot more on our local charities and, you know, what they do within our communities and how vital those things are.
Burns says local artists are vital, too. That's why he hopes to do more online concerts during the stay-at-home order, perhaps using other social media platforms in addition to Facebook Live. Burns says musicians can perform for tips or a local charity. He says either way, it's another step toward emerging from this crisis as a stronger community. Rich Egger reporting.
Next week will mark 155 years since Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. We've all heard how the U.S. was sent into a period of shock and grief when word of Lincoln's murder spread. Newspapers reported it that way. But what about the average American, North or South, white or black? Martha Hodes set out to learn more from their letters and personal notations. The NYU professor wrote a book on the subject called Mourning Lincoln, and it brings the intimate thoughts to light in the months after Lincoln died. She talked with us on Statewide.
Well, lots of people have written about Lincoln's assassination, but most scholars and writers who've written about Lincoln have written about public responses. So they've used newspaper articles or sermons or public expressions of condolence, and all of those are important points. But nobody had thought to read through the hundreds and hundreds of letters and diaries and other personal writings that were created in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, so literally in the hours, days, and weeks following Lincoln's assassination. So by reading through these sources, and I did read through hundreds and hundreds of such sources, of course there are many I didn't get to, but by reading through those sources, we get a different vision. We get a vision of a nation that is not united in mourning. which is something that many of the public sources claim. We get a vision of a nation quite divided right at the end of a civil war that terribly divided the nation. So that's what was so interesting to me. The personal responses illuminate a key moment of confusion and conflict that's been left out of the story.
Certainly, people in the South may have taken quite often a different view of Lincoln when he was alive and even in death. Is it your take that maybe people might have felt differently about his assassination had it not been for the Civil War, and especially had it not been so close to the end, the defeat of the Confederacy?
For Confederates, the trauma of the moment was less Lincoln's assassination than the fact that they had just lost this terrible four-year bloody war. And you can see that in personal writings of Confederates, because at times they will make a notation of the assassination but spend most of their time lamenting the defeat. Now, when Confederates thought about Lincoln and Lincoln's assassination, two things happened. First, Confederates did despise Lincoln, and that was because of the Civil War, and of course his election is what prompted secession. But the other point that's so interesting is at the same time the Confederates are celebrating Lincoln's assassination, because it's almost like a moment of reprieve for them from the horror of defeat, they're also worried because they have this sense that Lincoln would have been good to them had he lived, whether or not that's true. So while the freed people are calling Lincoln their best friend after his assassination, so are white Southerners calling Lincoln their best friend right after assassination. By the way, that wasn't something that developed later over the years and decades of the Lost Cause. It was something I found on the day Lincoln died.
And there has always been that theory that Reconstruction might have gone differently had Lincoln lived. People were worried, you know, what happens to me? What happens to the South? What happens to the way of life that I've known? And especially with somebody unknown taking the White House.
Think at first, or I should really say white Northerners and white Southerners think at first that Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, the vice president, is going to be tougher on former slaveholders and the Confederates because Johnson is known to have hated the Southern aristocracy. African Americans, however, have a sense right from the start that this is not going to be the case. And African Americans know this, and I realize this through reading letters in black newspapers and Frederick Douglass and other kinds of black voices. Johnson's roots are as a poor white Southerner, and they make the point, African-American mourners make the point, that Johnson hates black people more than he hates the Southern aristocracy. And that's, of course, what turns out to be true in Reconstruction. Johnson essentially sides with the Confederates and dismisses African-Americans. And I have many petitions and letters that African-American mourners wrote to Johnson saying things like, think about what your noble predecessor would have done, you know, were he alive. And Johnson does not follow through on the policies of black, not just black freedom. I mean, freedom has been gained, but equality, citizenship, land, education. So we do not know, we cannot know what would have happened had Lincoln lived. But there is a sense, and Frederick Douglass makes this point, that he would have listened to black petitioners. He would have listened to African Americans, the freed people, black politicians, black leaders, in a way that Johnson did not. Johnson dismissed those people out of hand when the war was over and he took the presidency.
For African Americans, they had had one of their, you know, one of the greatest victories that they had known up to that point during Lincoln's presidency, emancipation. Without Lincoln there, many of them felt as though that the rug would be pulled back out from under them, correct?
Absolutely. Of course, African Americans had been critical of Lincoln during the war. They thought that he was too slow to act upon emancipation. By the time the war was over, Lincoln had been influenced greatly by African Americans and by white abolitionists as well. And of course, there was the Emancipation Proclamation by then. There was the second inaugural address by then in which Lincoln made clear that slavery was the cause of the war and God would not let the war end until slavery was over. And then there was the last speech that Lincoln made. Of course, no one knew it would be his last speech when he stood on the White House balcony on April 11th, in which he hinted at his preference for suffrage for certain groups of black men. So once Lincoln was assassinated, African Americans, you're absolutely right, were devastated and proceeded to invoke Lincoln as a model of a radicalism that he may or may not have lived up to had he lived. But the fear among African Americans was very great, and white mourners conceded that the loss was greater for African Americans than for themselves. In their diaries and letters, they would make that point.
We're talking with Professor Martha Hodes. She's the author of Mourning Lincoln, which looks at Lincoln's assassination and the public's response. You feel as though that the public may be a little misinformed when it comes to Reconstruction and how that was handled because of Lincoln's death?
Yes. So there is a misconception that because Lincoln was assassinated, the North was harsher on the vanquished Confederacy. What I found in reading through all of these sources was that people understood, Lincoln's mourners understood the assassination as a message from God indicating that God had to take Lincoln away because otherwise the Confederates would not be treated with the kind of harshness they needed to be treated with in order to make the nation move forward. So instead of avenging Lincoln's assassination, the Union wanted to avenge war, secession and war, and also slavery, because people were very clear, mourners were very clear, not only abolitionists, that Lincoln was assassinated because of slavery. Of course, Booth was to blame and Confederate leaders were to blame, but slavery was the cause of the assassination. And people made that comment even before they went to church on Easter Sunday, and ministers made that comment. The treatment of the Confederates during Reconstruction was a result of everything that had led up to Reconstruction without the assassination making it any worse. That's not what people were avenging. And I think it's very important to understand that people took this, Lincoln's mourners took this as a message from God to move the nation, especially in the view of black and white radicals, giving African Americans the vote, education, land, citizenship, equality, freedom.
And we talked about the South, but what about the North? And what we've always heard, as you'd mentioned earlier, was that newspaper accounts were that the North was in a terrible mourning after the assassination. Is that what you found in these personal writings?
Well, yes, in many ways. I expected to find that the major responses would be shock and grief, and they were. So people were utterly astounded, stupefied. They couldn't believe it was real. They were overcome with gloom and grief. Men were weeping in the streets. All of that was true. What I also found in the North was that Lincoln's opponents, the so-called Copperheads, were celebrating the assassination in some of the same ways that Confederates were celebrating the assassination. So they were reveling, they were laughing and clapping and cheering in the streets. Of course, some people stayed out of sight for fear, and the ones who did demonstrate that kind of glee were threatened and sometimes visited with violence. They made jokes about Lincoln. Just to give one example, one man made the comment that he has as much of a brain now as he ever had, which was a reference to John Wilkes Booth shooting him in the head. Union soldiers and sailors who were Copperheads said terrible things about Lincoln and were visited by the wrath of their comrades. So not even the North was wholly unified. And what's so interesting is that Lincoln's mourners will say in one sentence, the whole world is mourning. And then in the next sentence in a diary or letter, we'll describe some of the people in their town who are not mourning Lincoln, but who are reacting with glee. So they know it's not true, but it's a kind of comforting trope that the whole world is mourning for Lincoln.
Many of us, if we didn't live through it, certainly have seen many times the assassination of John F. Kennedy on television and the film that that has become so famous of that. We didn't have that film of Lincoln. Do you think those two incidents were treated differently because of the lack of the visual imagery, or could you tell that from what you were reading?
When Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, people got the news from television or radio, and then television was the key way of making this real, that this had really happened. If you didn't have a television at home in 1963, you stood out on the sidewalk in front of an appliance store watching television in the window, in a crowd of people. Today, if there was a catastrophe, people would turn to their cell phones and social media. When Lincoln was assassinated, people would get the news from a telegram or the newspaper, sometimes the morning it happened if the telegraph lines were connected. And then it seemed so unbelievable that the first thing people did in 1865 was leave the house and verify that this had happened by looking into one another's faces. So over and over again in diaries and letters, I would find descriptions of people saying, I immediately got up from the breakfast table. I got dressed. I went outside. I looked into the stricken faces around me. I saw expressions of horror and grief. I saw tears rolling down people's cheeks. People knocked on doors. They rapped on windows. They told other people. The way to see that this had really happened was to verify human expressions. So sometimes I like to say not Facebook, but human faces in 1865. That was essential to understanding that this event had really come to pass.
Martha Hodes is author of Mourning Lincoln. The book focuses on Lincoln's death and reaction to it. Well, still to come, heading to the grocery store. We'll visit one and find out what changes have been put in place due to the coronavirus. Stay with us for more of Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll head out to a grocery store to see how they're working to keep shoppers and employees safe. And we'll check out how one neighborhood is coming together at a distance. Up next, in rural areas, people have to travel far to get groceries and other essential items. And lately, a lot of household and food items have been hard to come by. With kids learning from home, parents have their hands full. But families can often count on their local school districts to provide two meals a day for their kids. For Harvest Public Media, Katie Pikus tags along on a school meal delivery in southwest Iowa.
Where's everybody at? Hey!
That's Mike Wells. He's the superintendent for the Essex and Hamburg school districts in southwest Iowa. He's video chatting with me as he delivers lunch and breakfast to Nicole Hines' home in Hamburg. Hines and three of her kids are all outside on this warm and windy day.
So how's the internet working?
Good.
Good.
Wells recently gave Hines and her family a Wi-Fi hotspot so they can have internet access and do online learning with their teachers. Today he's brought seven meal bags for the seven children in Hines' house.
I have three of my own. The other four are my nieces and my nephew.
Hines and her fiancé have been caring for all four of her sister's kids since last year. With all of the kids out of school, school districts like this are giving kids two meals a day, 5 days a week. Hines says the meals save her from spending money on extra lunch meat and bread for the kids.
They're 9, 6, 5, 4, 12, 12, and 13, so they're eating constantly. I think every 5 minutes I hear, "I'm hungry," come out of someone's mouth, if not everybody's.
And getting food in rural areas isn't always easy. A couple weeks ago, Laura Dumler's family ran out of cereal, so she sent her husband from their home in Essex to the closest grocery store about 7 miles away.
And the aisle was desolate. All the shelves were, like, vacant. There was nothing there. And it finally clicked in my mind, like, oh my God, what are we going to do?
She and her husband don't have enough money to stock up on tons of food, and they only have one car, making frequent trips to the store hard. The food pantry they go to has closed amid the COVID-19 pandemic, but the school meals have been one sure thing.
To have something that we can count on, knowing that the kids are going to have a lunch and a breakfast, you know, every day through the week, is one thing that puts our mind at ease.
School districts in large urban areas have meal pickup sites at schools and near some apartment complexes. But it's up to staff at the Essex and Hamburg school districts to hand-deliver meals to kids' homes. So that means sometimes Dumler's kids get to see a familiar face, like their teachers or principal.
Usually they don't even make it to the house. My kids meet them out at the street, and I have to remind them, you know, that we have to be social distancing ourselves and, you know, air high fives and things of that nature.
Superintendent Mike Wells says as good as it is to see the kids, it's more important to the many families living paycheck to paycheck.
They don't have gas in their vehicles, they don't have groceries, and they don't have the ability really to go get groceries.
So he wanted his staff to deliver the meals so they could check in on families and see what else they might need. Back at her home in Hamburg, Nicole Hines says the meal deliveries and a quick visit really brighten the day.
It's a big joy. He's helped out tremendously.
Southwest Iowa hasn't been a hotbed for COVID-19, but if that changes, Wells says the in-person visits may have to end.
And we've talked about that we'd go more to a knock on the door and not greet. And we would put out a notice to our parents. It's nothing personal.
A move to protect families from community spread of COVID-19. But his school districts won't stop getting kids the food they need. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Katie Pikus.
New state data shows African Americans are dying in greater numbers from COVID-19 than other racial groups in Illinois. Member station WBEZ first reported on the disproportionate number of blacks dying in Chicago, but it's not only a city problem. Statewide, blacks have accounted for 42% of the state's deaths, according to the Illinois Department of Public Health. By contrast, African Americans represent just under 15% of Illinois' population. The state public health director, Ngozi Ezike, attributed the higher death rate to greater percentages of hypertension, diabetes, and heart disease among African Americans. And she says many live in areas with poor access to quality health care. The state of Illinois is expanding support for emergency child care centers. Governor J.B. Pritzker says Illinois' essential workers can qualify for financial assistance that will pay all or part of the cost of child care needs. He says children should be kept at home to slow the spread of COVID-19, but that's not always possible.
We have essential workers and health care professionals who can't stay home with their kids because they are heroically going out to do their jobs, which are vital for public safety and to make sure that other families can get the food and gas and pharmacy goods that they may need.
The state is also paying a higher reimbursement rate to emergency child care centers and home daycare operations to make sure they remain open. Those wishing to reopen can apply for a permit. You're listening to Statewide. The ongoing COVID-19 pandemic could end up costing Illinois state government tens of billions of dollars over the next few years. Sam Dunklaw has more on that.
That's one of the key takeaways from the latest report from the U of I's Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Using models to determine how the virus might impact income and sales taxes, researchers say Illinois realistically could lose some $18 billion over 3 years. That's billions more than was lost during the Great Recession. Ken Criz helped author the research. He says that's bad news, especially since Illinois has almost no savings.
One of the reasons why you keep an adequate fund balance and a rainy day fund is for rainy days, and right now it seems to be pouring.
State pensions and human services are likely to suffer too, Criz says, but just how much and for how long remains an open question. I'm Sam Dunklaw.
Grocery shopping is one activity that Illinois residents can leave the house for under the state's stay-at-home order, but even that experience should be approached with caution to avoid spreading the new coronavirus. Mary Hansen has more on what to do on your next grocery store run.
The changes to how we shop start as soon as you walk in the store.
Can I get your cart? Yes, please.
An employee at a county market in Springfield wipes down cart handles and edges with a bleach solution.
They're doing it so the customer sees, okay, they just did this. It's another sense of comfort for them.
Jerry Kettler is director of consumer affairs for Neiman Foods, which owns dozens of county markets in Illinois. He shows me the measures they're taking to keep customers and employees safe. At a distance, of course, with the help of an extra mic and an extra long cord.
I'll hand you this.
Okay.
We're trying to follow the signs instructing people to stay 6 feet apart, which Governor J.B. Pritzker and the Illinois Retail Merchants Association recently recommended for grocery stores to use. There's also plexiglass in front and behind cashiers to limit contact, and they're wearing gloves. Kettler says people are abiding by the rules, but I tell him the last time I went out for groceries, I saw many who didn't seem to understand just what 6 feet looks like. He offers this rule of thumb.
Two shopping carts distance is about 6 foot, so you can just kind of measure one shopping cart and the next one, and then you're 6 foot away.
There's yellow and orange duct tape on the floor to show customers where to wait at the pharmacy or at the cash register, another method for keeping distance. As we make our way through the store, I ask Kettler a question that's on a lot of customers' minds. Do you have any toilet paper?
I don't know that we have toilet paper, but we have, here we are, booty wipes.
Packs of wet wipes are next to empty shelves where rolls would have been, with signs that read limit one in all caps. Kettler says availability depends on the store.
We'll get a truck in, and then they're sold out within 45 minutes, which would normally last us for quite a bit of time. And I understand the consumer fear, but what I would like to tell everybody is that let the supply chain catch up a little.
So far on our grocery shopping do list, we have wipe down the carts and stay 6 feet away from other customers. The don'ts: don't overbuy things like toilet paper or soap. Kettler has one more for the don't list.
Don't use this as a family outing. Send one person to do the grocery shopping.
This last one may be hard, since a lot of us are cooped up in the house for most of the day. But Dr. Vidya Sundaresan says it's important.
We want to be as strict as possible with the social distancing.
Sundaresan is an infectious disease specialist and medical consultant to the Sangamon County Department of Public Health. She says make the grocery runs quick and try to avoid touching too many things. And the precaution shouldn't end after you buy the groceries. Sundaresan says to use hand sanitizer when leaving the store. When you get home, wipe with an alcohol-based cleaner or bleach the cans and glass bottles and the countertops where you set grocery bags.
Wiping down those surfaces definitely decreases the burden of virus. And same is the case with cans or glass jars. Somebody sneezed around that and the virus is still hanging around on that.
The precautions may seem burdensome or over the top, but Sundaresan says Illinois hasn't had the surge yet in cases that's expected. She says modeling suggests that could happen between April 15th and May 15th.
All that time is the virus spread is going to get worse. The risk is definitely there even now, and it's going to get worse.
On the brighter side, Sundaresan says social distancing does work.
So those are some of the inconveniences of social distancing, inconveniences of what we are going through right now. But it's very important that we continue to maintain what we are doing, continue to even tighten what we are doing to make sure that we are able to slow the virus down.
I'm Mary Hansen.
Governor Pritzker and the Illinois Retail Merchants Association have recommended guidelines for grocery stores. Those include barriers in front and behind cashiers to limit contact, making periodic store announcements about social distancing, and encouraging self-checkout and cashless purchases. The coronavirus has canceled big events. It's even put a stop to most small gatherings in homes and backyards. But on one block in Chicago's northwest suburbs, neighbors have found a way to be together, even as they keep apart. Dan Mihalopoulos reports.
It's late in the afternoon on the third Tuesday of Illinois' stay-at-home order. Most of northwest suburban Mount Prospect is so quiet, all you can hear is the birds chirping. But on one block, about a dozen people are outside. Mike and Nancy Naranjo are sitting in front of their house. They've broken out their best bottles of Wisconsin craft beer.
I am holding a New Glarus Spotted Cow. The good stuff.
Gotta break it open for this, right? For sure.
This is what they call driveway happy hour on the 500 block of North Russell Street. The Naranjo's neighbor, Candy Durst, came up with the idea last week after she got furloughed from her job as a corporate travel agent.
Our neighbors are the best, so we always like to have fun and do something.
Every summer, they throw a block party they call Russellmania. But Durst said the coronavirus outbreak called for more immediate action. She posted about the driveway happy hour on Facebook.
I knew everyone was sitting at home, not doing anything. I'm like, it's funny because then I put it on the Mount Prospect neighbors and there was almost 300 responses. And then other neighborhoods are like, why aren't we doing this?
Besides drinking, everybody at the driveway happy hour just sort of shouts across or down the street at one another. There's not much else to do these days, says Mike Naranjo, who retired as Mount Prospect's postmaster.
I mean, I'm a Netflix guy now. Breaking Bad, awesome. Better Call Saul, saw that. Just started Ozark.
Another neighbor, Flo Polina, said she and her husband, Vince, were happy just to see everybody.
And we're all excited to, you know, come out of the house.
And don't worry, everybody's sociable, but they're practicing social distancing.
We're 6 feet apart. Hey, I'm 5'1". Really?
Give me a tape measure.
Nobody wants to take any chances. For example, Mike Naranjo asks Vince Polina to toss some of his tasty peanut butter pretzels across the street into his wide open mouth. You know, just typical block party messing around, right?
Don't get too close, I said.
This time, though, they quickly think better of sharing the pretzels.
You didn't throw one. You didn't want to waste one.
You want Corona for me, do you?
I'm being careful, too. I've come to report on the happy hour with a mask and gloves. My microphone is attached to the end of a broomstick with shiny silver duct tape. But Mike Naranjo helps keep the mood light by taking out his cell phone and playing a new song. Yep, that's a parody of My Sharona, only it's My Corona. Then, as the party wraps up, there's talk of what they'll drink at the next driveway happy hour.
I will bring limoncello next time, yes, Friday.
And the precautions they'll have to take to enjoy those drinks.
Well, it's in a bottle. Just leave it there. We'll get rubber gloves. Everybody gets a rubber glove and pour yourself.
The Russell Maniacs say all are welcome to join them at their driveway happy hour. Just make sure not to get too close. Dan Michalopoulos, WBEZ.
That does it for Statewide for this week. Thanks for joining us. Be with us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Don't forget, you can get our podcast through the NPR One app and find all of our episodes at statewideshow.com. Stay safe and stay home. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.